Welcome to our current broadcast of Indie Week. The North Carolina Reading Service presents John Federson, who reads to our audience of listeners who are blind and print impaired. The date of this issue, March the 3rd, 2021. And our music today is provided by a meme. And our meme for today is Noti McNoteface. Noti McNoteface. Maybe some of you have heard of it. Our opening article, starting Wednesday, North Carolina's essential workers can get vaccinated for COVID-19. This week, the rollout will extend to frontline essential workers, including grocery store employees, meatpacking workers, and government employees. Governor Roy Cooper announced that residents in Group 3 can start to receive the vaccine starting yesterday. The state plans to open a FEMA-supported vaccine site in Greensboro on March 10, which will distribute up to 3,000 vaccines a day. Excuse me, I said yesterday. That must mean next week. March the 10th. The state also expects to receive 80,000 doses of Johnson & Johnson's one-dose vaccine starting tomorrow. Governor Cooper said during a press conference, "Our constant request for more vaccines have been answered." As of Tuesday, the state has administered more than 2.5 million doses of vaccine. Among those, 60% of the state's seniors have already been vaccinated. Group 4, which includes residents with underlying medical conditions, will be able to sign up to receive a vaccine starting March 24. North Carolina's COVID numbers have decreased and stabilized in recent weeks. The percent of people testing positive for the virus has dropped to 5.7 from a high of 18% earlier this year. The number of daily reported cases is also down. 1,239 new cases reported Tuesday, a fraction of the 10,000 a day the state reported during that post-holiday surge in January. In response, last week Cooper lifted restrictions, including a 10 p.m. curfew and 9 p.m. cutoff on alcohol sales. He warned, "We know that progress is fragile. We all must continue to wear our masks and have good judgment." The state has completed more than 10 million tests for the virus and has reported 863,000 cases. As of Tuesday, 1,353 people remain hospitalized with the virus and 11,288 people have died. Next, by Sarah Pequeno, a new bill aims to rid North Carolina of its arbitrary abortion laws. This bill, a new bill, is looking to cut through the state's regressive, redundant anti-abortion laws that make it harder for marginalized groups to access the procedure that is protected as a federal right. The Remove Barriers, Gain Access to Abortion Act, or RBG bill, was filed in the state legislature by representatives across the state in an effort to remove some of the controversial, restrictive policies passed by the General Assembly in recent years. It was named in honor of late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and filed on the first day of Women's History Month. Mars Earl, engagement director of North Carolina Abortion Fund, said in a press release, "Decades of attacks on reproductive freedom by this General Assembly have increased the risks and expenses related to abortion care, making it more inaccessible for people of color, people who live in rural areas, and people of lower incomes." The RBG Act would reverse previous attacks on reproductive freedom and would make reproductive health care safer and more accessible. While North Carolina is less restrictive than other southern states, it still has some of the strictest anti-abortion policies in the country. The RBG bill takes aim at four of these: the 72-hour delay between receiving state-mandated counseling and having the abortion, the restrictions on who can perform an abortion and where, redundant bans on Medicaid coverage of abortions, and the ban on abortions being performed via telemedicine if the patient opts for the medicinal procedure. multiple Triangle legislators are involved with the bill. Representative Julie Van Hayten, House District 36, Vanetta Alston, District 29, are primary co-sponsors in the House, while Senators Natalie Murdoch from District 20 and Jay Chaudhuri, 15, are co-sponsors in their chamber. Van Hayten said in a press conference Monday, "This is particularly important during the pandemic. The public health crisis has limited access to health care dramatically in a time when family planning is more important than ever for people. North Carolinians can only terminate unwanted pregnancies in 9 counties. Most are home to the state's cities or colleges and are situated in the Piedmont region. Despite the scarcity of clinics, at least 2 people in every county reported having an abortion in 2019, according to data collected by DHHS. The majority of people who receive abortions have never had an abortion before, are unmarried, and have them before 8 weeks gestation time, according to data reported to the state. Current laws are often redundant, including the state's Medicaid bans, the federal Hyde Amendment doesn't allow public money to cover abortion, and the personnel and facility requirements, despite no reported difference in safety if the procedure is performed at a clinic instead of a surgery center. Other laws and recent bills have worked to restrict access even more, such as the 2019 failed Born Alive bill that would have imposed extra regulations on providers, and a 2015 ban on abortions after 20 weeks that was eventually shot down by federal court. A September 2020 lawsuit brought by the Center for Reproductive Rights is tackling 5 more anti-abortion laws in the state, including several issues addressed in the RBG bill. Now, there are 2 articles in this Indie Week about garden terrace apartments over in Durham. First, at Durham's Garden Terrace Apartments in Lakewood, resident Marieri Sarmiento is tired of being ignored. Her apartment is riddled with maintenance concerns, she told the Indy through a translator, and her requests for repairs regularly go unanswered. Wood is rotting under the kitchen sink, mold is growing on air vents in the bathroom, water seeps under the front door when it rains, she says, and a wooden cabinet is missing its 4th wall. Sarmiento says her husband, Santos Ortiz, has been fixing things himself, but hasn't received reimbursement. Anything in here that's working well is because we've fixed it ourselves, she says. Sarmiento and Ortiz are not alone. Following months of property managers allegedly ignoring their complaints, a group of Garden Terrace residents, many of whom are immigrants and low income, have banded together to demand repairs. City inspectors have since found numerous housing code violations at the 56-unit complex, and maintenance work is now underway. But some residents call the repairs an inadequate short-term solution to larger problems. Since fall, tenants have worked to protect and expand their rights. They're calling on Jonathan Diane, who manages the investment group that owns Garden Terrace, to begin negotiations for new lease agreements. The standoff between Dayan and the tenants escalated last month when protesters marched to Dayan's home to demand repairs and stable rent. In November, a group of tenants gathered in Raleigh outside the office of Wilson Property Management, the company that manages Garden Terrace, to protest what they called unsafe living conditions and cases of unfair evictions. Tenants said they had submitted countless maintenance requests but never saw the repairs completed. Many families face mold, rotting wood, and plumbing issues in their units. Wilson owner Beth Black met with the tenants that day. She asked for specific maintenance requests so they could begin repairs, she says, but only received 2 work orders from the residents in attendance. Following the protest, tenants contacted Durham's Neighborhood Improvement Services Department. According to department records, city officials began inspecting the complex in December and found more than 120 housing code violations. Records cite excessive dampness, faulty or missing smoke detectors, and improper sanitation. They also noted loose flooring, flaking paint, and ventilation issues in bathrooms. Before the city inspectors got involved, tenants said their complaints fell on deaf ears. But Black and Dayan said they were not aware of any issues prior to that demonstration. Black says, we had no idea things had gotten so bad because the tenants weren't turning anything into us. Tenants can submit maintenance requests through a resident portal or by calling Wilson directly, Black says. Dayan added that it's impossible to erase records of tenants' requests for repairs. Dayan and Black say they are now working with the city to address problems at Garden Terrace. Both say they wish they were aware of the situation earlier. We gave them instructions on how to submit work orders, Dayan says, but we don't know what's going on inside the units unless they tell us. Sarmiento and her family tell a different story. She says she called and emailed multiple times to request maintenance, but never got a response. Dayan told the Indy that maintenance teams are currently working on Sarmiento's unit. The tenants' goals are my goals, Dayan says. I want Garden Terrace to be a nice place to live. Black is relieved that city inspectors brought the condition to her attention, she says. Dayan doesn't want them living like that. I don't want them living like that. My property manager doesn't want them living like that. We want to get it fixed. We want to get it right and for everybody to be safe and happy. The severe maintenance issues at Garden Terrace have shed light on a broader struggle. Residents have teamed up with community organizers to rectify what they say is an uneven power dynamic between tenants and their landlord, forming the Garden Terrace Tenants Union in December with the help of Durham-based Bull City Tenants United. Fanny Sarmiento, the union's president, and Marieri's sister, says that roughly three-fourths of Garden Terrace residents have joined the union. Many feel neglected and taken advantage of, she says. Fanny Sarmiento says she believes Dayan is trying to force the tenants out of their homes by refusing to repair their units, rendering them unlivable. Once the units are empty, she says, she suspects Dayan will hike the prices and look for new renters. In October, Governor Roy Cooper issued an executive order strengthening federal protections against eviction in North Carolina during the pandemic. Those federal protections are in place through the end of the month. The union is the tenants' way of standing up for themselves, Sarmiento says. She believes they are stronger together than they would be as individuals. The union wants a collective lease agreement that would give each tenant access to fair treatment and acceptable living conditions. They want to open negotiations with Dayan to establish a binding contract that would ensure prompt repairs, keep rents stable, and prevent unfair evictions. On February 7th, the Garden Terrace residents invited Dayan to meet with them to begin negotiations for a lease agreement, but he did not attend. They say they've never received a direct reply from Dayan, despite reaching out multiple times. Dayan says many of the tenants' demands are not legally feasible. The leases used at Garden Terrace are approved by the NC Bar Association, he says, and cannot be adjusted once a tenant has signed. And he told the Indy, I hope to have that conversation with the tenants and explain it to them directly, but we will not set that kind of precedent of renegotiating a lease. Furthermore, Dayan says he's not able to negotiate collectively. There is no legal entity called the Garden Terrace Tenants Union, he says. I'm more than happy to meet with any individual leaseholder, but I can't do anything with this group. Dayan says he is willing to meet with a small, socially distanced group to discuss concerns and explain the situation. But so far, the tenants' attempts to meet have been outside of business hours and against public health guidelines, Dayan says. Tenants invited Dayan to meet with them on Sunday, February 21st. After he didn't show up, they marched to his Durham home to voice their demands. Dayan says he received the information but will not attend a meeting on the weekend. Wilson property manager Deanna Sweat replied to the invitation via email, stating that the company understands tenants' concern about maintenance and housing security and offering to meet with a, quote, COVID-sensitive size group. She wrote, we would also like to tell you about our ongoing maintenance work so far and the plan going forward so we can have a transparent process, and also happy to conduct a short training on the web portal we use for maintenance requests so that nothing gets lost in the cracks moving forward. Dayan says tenants did not reply to Sweat's email. Many do not speak English, complicating the dispute. He says he was not expecting dozens of protesters to come to his home on a Sunday, and he felt unfairly targeted and had trouble communicating with the group. He says, I told them there have not been any evictions, but they don't trust me. I don't know what to do. I don't want to sue them, but they have crossed a lot of lines. He says the group marched up his driveway and began chanting at him while his son was playing in the backyard. The residents and their supporters say they won't be deterred. In a media advisory from Bull City Tenants United, leaders wrote they remain determined to negotiate a binding contract. The release said the tenants will be inviting more members of the community to join them, planning to turn up the heat in the event Dayan continues to ignore them. Dayan says he wants to help the tenants and is working hard to complete the maintenance repairs as quickly as possible, but he won't discuss the possibility of a reformed lease agreement. A lease is a binding contract, he says. Legally, we can't do anything. The second Garden Terrace article by Carolyn Petra-Gowen. We were receiving threats. The conflict worsens. When property managers at Durham's Garden Terrace Apartments told resident Julie Williams to vacate her home, she turned to her community for support. Williams, who's lived at the complex at Lakewood for 6 years, says she was notified Monday morning that she had until 5 p.m. that day to move out. She says, they told me I had to turn in my keys, and I told them I don't have no place to go. Williams lives in a three-bedroom unit with her brother, Joseph, and her two sons, 17-year-old Diamond and 20-year-old Donovan. Now, community activists are fighting to help Williams stay in her apartment. Williams' struggle is just the latest development in a month-long conflict between residents and property managers. A group of residents formed that Garden Terrace Tenants Union in December, primarily to protest overdue maintenance requests and unacceptable living conditions. The union, which receives support from Durham advocacy group Bull City Tenants United, ultimately wants a new lease agreement for each tenant that would provide additional rights. Residents and their supporters have held multiple rallies and even protested outside the home of Jonathan Dayan, who manages that investment group that owns Garden Terrace. On Monday, they turned their attention toward helping Williams stay in her home. Union members took to social media to ask the community to contact Wilson Property Management, the company that manages Garden Terrace, and demand that Williams not be evicted. According to a BCTU Facebook post, Williams was offered a year-long lease in February, but the offer was suddenly revoked on March the 1st. Beth Black, owner of Wilson Property Management, says the situation is not that simple and Williams is not actually being evicted. Black says Williams was never on a lease at Garden Terrace. The leaseholder for her unit, who Williams had been living with, moved out unexpectedly last fall. Black says her company offered to transfer the month-to-month lease to Williams' name, but doing so would make Williams responsible for a back rent fee that the previous leaseholder had accumulated. To avoid this, Wilson Property Management advised Williams to apply for a brand new lease for which he was approved in February. The new lease requires a $600 security deposit and monthly payments of $975, which Black says is the current market price. Williams was previously paying around $770 per month for rent, she says, and can't afford the higher rate. Black says Williams was asked to leave the unit on March 1st because she never signed her lease. Williams is still in her apartment and asking Wilson Property Management to lower her rent. Meanwhile, Black and Dayan say they're facing extreme harassment from the tenants' union and their supporters. Deanna Sweat, the Wilson employee who oversees Garden Terrace, says she has received more than 50 voicemails regarding Williams' lease, posts circulating on social media originating from the BCTU Facebook page share Sweat's full name and blame her for the situation. Many of the messages were personal, hateful attacks, Black says. I had to send all my employees home from the office yesterday, she says. We were receiving threats. Recordings of the messages obtained by the Indy contain profanity directed at Sweat. Diane says the Bull City Tenants United is spreading misinformation in order to fuel anger toward the management company. Diane says their posts on social media are full of false information. The harassment that's going on right now is way beyond normal. Black did not say whether her company would agree to lower Williams' rent. She feels attacked by the community, she says, and is seeking legal guidance before moving forward. Now for an article again about Durham, East Durham. An inclusive, intentional, new bookstore cafe comes to East Durham. Emma Kenfield wrote this. When the image of a library comes to mind, it's often stuffy and still, pairing literature with silence. Conversely, mention of a hip new coffee shop might conjure images of young professionals, glowing Apple logos, and the clattering rush of keyboards. But when Bev Tumi Mahubile and Naledi Yazio picture their creation, the Rofiwa Book Cafe, they see color, accessibility, and a celebration of Black culture. Rofiwa will be located on the southwest corner of Anger Avenue and South Driver Street in Old East Durham. The name means "we have been given" in Tshivenda, a language of South Africa. Yazio says, "I like to imagine that on a Saturday morning when a family is deciding what to do with the day, Rofiwa might be a part of their plans." In early February, Mahubile and Yazio launched the bookshop website. They hope to open the shop doors in March. When they do, the pair plan to carry a carefully curated selection of adult and children's books by Black authors and serve coffee from Black roasters. The vision, they say, is of a vibrant space that fosters conversation and community. As a child, Mahubile noticed that the books they were encouraged to read in school did not match the books their mother talked about reading growing up. They were excited about Goosebumps, while their mother could recite whole passages from certain African novels. A piece of a cultural connection and representation was missing. In 2014, Mahubile began sorting through their mother's belongings and dug out her well-loved copy of Megokyo Ya Byoko by South African author O.K. Matsepe. The wrinkled paperback helped them discover a passion for collecting rare and out-of-print novels by Black authors. Mahubile says, "A lot of these books go out of print and then they disappear. I wanted to get my hands on as many as I could in this life anyway." Shortly after, in 2017, Mahubile decided they wanted to make these rare novels accessible to children and adults in a space that felt like home, and thus Rofiwa was born. Yazio, who is curating the book selection, has unorthodox ideas about the way a bookstore can be organized. She wants to reimagine the typical shelving of bookstores and libraries, where genres are sorted categorically. She thinks of literature as a living being and wants to group books in conversation with one another. Yazio said, "A crime novel can sit next to a romance, yes. But at Rofiwa, a crime novel is sitting next to a romance and a piece of historical fiction, and what's special about it is that they are from different regions where Black people live and make life, and they reflect different experiences. Take Mpumi's Magic Beads, Lebohang Masango, a children's book set in Johannesburg that depicts a little girl who can transport out of the city by the magic beads in her hair. When intentionally placed beside James Baldwin's Little Man, Little Man, a story of a child living in Brooklyn, it becomes part of a larger dialogue about the global limitations that city life poses for Black children wanting to play." Yazio says, "That conversation is held across time, across two very different cities, but there's a way you can read those books and not have those conversations. So I'm trying to think about how we can place those books in such a way that that conversation becomes obvious. Rufiwa is not the first black-owned bookstore to open in Durham. The No Bookstore, which was run by Bruce Bridges for 18 years on Fayetteville Street, was a long-time community cornerstone. Jazz club, soul food cafe, and lecture spot all in one. Its patrons remember the space as a celebration of black culture, one perfumed with the smell of incense and fried chicken. The bookstore shuttered in 2009, though, and today the space is vacant, with plans in the works for it to become a Checkers location. The historic 406 South Driver Street building, where Rofifa will open meanwhile, also has a storied past. In previous lives, it has been home to numerous community-centered spaces, including a pharmacy, physician's office, and a barber shop. Between 2018 and 2020, the space was occupied by a popular pie shop, East Durham Bake Shop, which closed abruptly in September amid employee allegations of a toxic workplace. Yazio and Mahubele hope to enhance the sense of community and black excellence that has long existed in the area. Neighboring black-owned businesses include a screen printing and t-shirt service, barbecue supply store, a diner, and two barbershops. Mahubele said, "I think when people say, 'We're so excited this corner is coming to life,' they mean the collective effort of everybody. We're just hoping to be half as good as our neighbors." In December, Mahubele and Yazio launched a Kickstarter campaign to fund the construction of Rofiwa. They were met with an outpouring of community support. By January 12th, the campaign had reached its goal of $40,000, accruing 1,032 backers in just over a month. Mahubele says, "We want to make something where black people feel like they deserve to be there. We live here. This is home for us, and this will be home for you." To Tomasi McDonald now, a black former consular officer chronicled alleged mistreatment by U.S. border officers. After her blog post went viral, she raised thousands for Durham organizations. Tiana Spears joined the United States Foreign Service because she wanted to represent America. In October of 2018, she started as a consular officer with the U.S. consulate in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Every day, she interviewed around 25 immigrants applying for U.S. visas for work, study, and travel. Spears, now a Durham resident, tells the Indie of Life in the Mexican city, which has been riddled by government corruption, drug-fueled gang violence, and poverty since the early 1990s. "It wasn't safe. I lived in a gated community with barbed wire and a security guard. But it wasn't Juarez crime and corruption that made Spears' work life difficult. Instead, it was officers with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the CPB, who turned her dream job into a nightmare." During her six-month tenure in Juarez, Spears says she experienced repeated racial profiling by CBP officers. Many of her trips back to the U.S. turned into drawn-out ordeals, as CBP officers regularly ordered Spears, who carried four different types of identification with her, to pull into a secondary line of cars where they questioned her embassy credentials. Time and again, she says, she was subjected to body and vehicle searches for drugs. Despite carrying a global entry card that ostensibly grants expedited clearance to pre-approved travelers. Later on her blog, What's Up with Tiana, Spears chronicled some of her experiences. This is a quote. "I drove my vehicle from my house in Mexico across the Isleta Zaragoza International Bridge into El Paso, Texas, on Saturday, January 19th, 2019. a CBP officer flagged me into secondary inspection for what I estimate was more than 15 times since I arrived in Mexico, at least once a week. The official inquired if I was a U.S. citizen, motive of travel in the United States, reason of visit in Mexico, and if the car I was driving was stolen. I sat on a cold bench and endured further questioning. I showed my diplomatic passport, stating I worked at the U.S. Consulate General in Ciudad Juarez and lived there. "Sure you do," he laughed. End quote. During the 6 months Spears worked in Juarez, she says she was harassed at least 25 times by CBP officers. "Clearly they knew who I was," she tells the Indy. She says the repeated harassment she experienced at the border and State Department's failure to address it after she filed complaints wore heavily on her. "I tried to speak up, but no one helped me," she says. "No one made the harassment stop." She sought the help of a therapist who diagnosed her with post-traumatic stress disorder, a severe anxiety disorder, and major depressive disorder. She says, "I'm a lot better, but I'm still very much impacted by what happened to me." Spears says she didn't feel safe sharing her experiences publicly until she returned to Durham and the last of her belongings were moved out of Mexico. 5 days after George Floyd died under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer, Spears says she drank a lot of coffee and wrote a lengthy blog post, "What Do I Want from the White People?" An illustration on being black in America, documenting the outrages by a country that sanctions police violence against black people, and detailing her experiences as a black woman working as a Foreign Service officer. The post, excerpted in this story, went viral. Another quote. "A new official appeared and searched my car, tossing around the contents in my back seat and glove compartment. He took his left hand and rubbed it up and down my car windows. 'I'm going to meet my friend in El Paso,' I stated. 'When you talk to a man, you look at the ground. Do you understand me?' He glared at me, face full of disgust. The officers laughed, my soldiers tense. 'May I speak to your manager, please?' The on-duty manager approached, crossing his arms, and asked, 'What do you want?' I told him about my negative interaction with the previous officers. The manager laughed and asked the motive of travel into the U.S. I told him I was going to meet a friend for coffee and was asked why I needed to come to the U.S. to partake in that activity. 'I'm a U.S. citizen,' I reiterated. Spears is a California native who moved to Durham with her parents when she was 9 years old. She recalls hearing the call to prayer from the Jamaat Ibad al-Rahman Mosque in the mornings and the Hillside High School band playing during football games. After graduating on a scholarship from Ravenscroft High School in Raleigh, Spears enrolled at North Carolina State University and earned a bachelor's degree in 2014, then a master's degree in international relations from Northeastern University. As an undergraduate, Spears studied in Costa Rica and became interested in working for the State Department. In 2018, the department selected her to participate in its Consular Fellows Program, where Americans interested in a career in Foreign Service can work adjudicating visas in a consulate abroad. She says, "I remember seeing the embassy and thinking I could work there. I wanted to travel, meet new friends, and represent the United States abroad. I knew there weren't too many people of color, especially black women. I knew America needed more representation across the board. I thought I was the perfect candidate." Another excerpt from her journal. "When I reiterated that his account of the frequency of secondary inspection was incorrect, the manager scoffed, his team standing behind him, almost mocking me. He said, 'Just because you say you work at the consulate doesn't mean that you are not smuggling drugs into the country.' Extremely frustrated and irritated, I asked how in the world I would be able to get top secret security clearance to work for the United States government. The manager then told me, 'I do not know, but I do know what drug dealers and smugglers look like.' When I asked him to explain, the manager stepped forward, attempting to intimidate me, crossed his arms, looked me up and down, and says, 'You know what I mean.' I was furious at his insinuation that I was a drug smuggler and his racially charged implication based off my appearance. I demanded an apology from the manager for the disgusting and unjust defamation of my name and character. Spears says she thinks the Trump administration's callousness toward people of color played a role in border officers' behavior toward her. She says the blunt racism, sexism, demagoguery, and xenophobia, all of that coming from the U.S. president, empowers and emboldens the Department of Homeland Security border officers to act in hostile and retaliatory ways. Spears also blames the State Department for creating a work environment that did not value her safety. Another quote. The CBP manager took another step forward to stand on top of the platform that the bench sits on, positioning him to be a couple inches taller than me. He placed his hand on his gun in the holster, finger around the trigger, and told me to get back in my car. His body language and his hand looked like he was just about to shoot. I didn't move. Shaking, I remember wondering if he would just shoot me. Why not? I had already said too much. Shaking, I requested his supervisor. The CBP supervisor came out to secondary inspection, greeting me by saying, "I remember you." The State Department employs some 76,000 people worldwide, according to a 2019 agency report, a third of whom are career Foreign Service officials and civil service employees. Black employees make up just over 15% of Forest Service and Civil Service employees, according to the department's 2019 five-year workforce plan. Just above the 13.4% of the African American percentage of the national population. Meanwhile, fewer women and people of color are represented in senior-level career jobs at the State Department than white men. While women account for over 42% of foreign and civil service leadership posts, Asian Americans comprise 4.5%, Hispanics 6%, and black people 10.7%. The border officers, from Sears' experiences, were never disciplined. Last week, a State Department spokesperson told the Indy on background that CBP officials became aware of Spears' allegations of repeated harassment and that an investigation was launched 4 days after she filed her complaint. On March 8th of 2019, following reviews by the Department of Homeland Security, the case was referred to the CBP's Office of Professional Responsibility in El Paso. The spokesperson wrote that in the CBP's review of a 30-second video of the incident involving the officer with a gun, quote, "The footage is clear that the officer never moved his hands toward his weapon, nor postured himself in a manner that could be construed as threatening or intimidating," and that Spears' quote, "public claim that a CBP officer effectively threatened her by placing his finger around the trigger of a firearm, is completely unsubstantiated and, in fact, contradicted by video evidence." The spokesperson later added the full investigation, quote, "found no evidence of misconduct." Less than a month after Spears filed her complaint, she was transferred over 1,000 miles away to the U.S. consulate in Mexico City, where she interviewed about 100 visa applicants each day. She quit working for the State Department in October of 2019. She explains, or more like was forced out, that the environment was not conducive to my mental health issues, and it was hard to fend for myself. This June, following her blog post going viral, Spears created a GoFundMe she called A Love Letter to Durham, where she wrote of her love for the city that raised and nurtured her, of a grandfather that worked at NC Mutual, and a grandmother who was a public school teacher. "I wanted to give back to black and brown organizations," Spears says. The campaign raised more than $33,000. Spears distributed the money to a handful of community organizations, including Black Girls CODE, Black Space, the Boys and Girls Clubs, Durham Literacy Center, El Centro Hispano, Urban Ministries of Durham, Walltown Children's Theater, and NC Central's Office of International Affairs for study abroad. Spears says she's healing while writing and seeking a more creative life. She's focusing on creating a storytelling platform for voices that aren't always heard or heeded. I want to be in a space where I'm growing, healing, and open to whatever opportunity presents itself, she says. On her blog, she writes, "You will rise again to face another day. Build a community. Love your mother, love your father. Go to church and sing a song. A local community center and support a friend and family member's small business. Gather for homecoming at the local historically black college and university that your dad's entire family attended. Build a scholarship fund for students in your family's honor. Hug your elders and ask them how they're doing. Listen. Protest. Vote. Celebrate your blackness. Continue to show up as your authentic self in all spaces. Dance. Share stories. Pray." Kathleen Hobson now writes, "Parents describe a wrenching year of Zoom fatigue as schools prepare to reopen." Mary Barzee's 7-year-old son, Leo, sits down at their kitchen table to begin another day of online school, a routine he has been stuck in all school year. As his teacher starts the lesson, she cannot see that behind the camera, her student is crafting paper airplanes and does not have his book open to the correct page. Barzee sits at the kitchen table with Leo, trying to balance working from home and helping her son with online school. She said in an interview, "This has already gone on for a year, and I'm in a pretty desperate situation with my first grader. He has major Zoom fatigue. He's regularly crying, and his self-esteem has taken a major hit. It's a disaster. His teachers are doing the best they can, but they cannot see what's happening on the other end of the screen." In a 5-2 vote in February, the Durham Public Schools Board approved a plan to begin bringing students back to school on March 15th, reversing a previous decision to keep classrooms closed for the rest of the school year. The vote, which arrived following almost a full school year of online instruction, came in response to Senate Bill 37, which proposed that all K-12 public schools open for in-person learning again, overriding any local school boards that had decided to keep them closed. Governor Roy Cooper vetoed the bill on Friday, and the state Senate failed by a single vote to override the governor's veto on Monday. Barzee said she will return Leo to in-person learning at George Watts Montessori Elementary School as soon as it is advisable, because he has struggled with virtual learning. At the same time, she acknowledges the concerns of educators who recently became eligible for the coronavirus vaccine and say they should be vaccinated before they are asked to return to school. She says, "I want to advocate for vaccines for teachers and other school staff who will be going back to teach in person. I have hopes that Durham schools can provide safe in-person learning environments for students and teachers too." Reopening schools could save other families from desperate situations. Kristen Cunningham said she had to quit her full-time job and find part-time work she could do at home for less money, just so she could oversee the online instruction of 3 children who are George Watts students. She said in an interview, "I feel kind of abandoned by the public school system because so many people rely on that system being in place to care for their children and be able to work. I work in healthcare, and I didn't have the option of working from home." Across the country, parents have had to make career sacrifices so that they can help their children with virtual learning during the COVID-19 pandemic. This burden most often has fallen on working mothers, who are nearly 3 times more likely than fathers to stay home and take care of the kids, according to research from the Census Bureau and the Federal Reserve. Barzi says, we're just barely hanging on. Everything to do with my job is dictated by my son's class schedule. Many parents are concerned that their young children are forced to spend too much time in front of their computers when they should be socializing and playing outside. Maria Catani of Clarendon Street said in an email to the DPS board, virtual instruction is not working for my first grader. Despite heroic attempts by her and the teacher, every day we end up in tears and tantrums. My kid has heart-wrenching meltdowns about how she wants to go back to school. She wants to play. She wants to do puzzles, Legos, build forts. Barzi has opted out of virtual art, music, and PE classes for her first grader and his preschool brother. She homeschools those subjects herself, so her boys won't have to spend their entire day online. She said, before the pandemic, we were extremely cautious about screen time. We didn't have a TV in our house. It's just been really difficult to watch my kids' attention span diminish. Pablo Ariel, also of Clarendon Street, said in an email to the DPS board how his six-year-old daughter had a meltdown over her virtual homework. She could not stop sobbing. She just repeated over and over, I just want to go to school. I just want to go to school. Ariel said, kids' voices have been absent from the discussions about reopening. Virtual learning for young kids is a failure, and they are suffering. For many children with individualized education plans, IEPs, online instruction is simply not an option. IEPs are special ed services tailored to serve children with disabilities or other challenges that might impede their success at school. The parent of a four-year-old boy who asked to be anonymous to protect privacy said in an interview, my son is autistic and will not do Zoom school, so he essentially is receiving no education at all this year from the school system, which I believe to be illegal and a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I feel disappointed at the lack of creativity or flexibility from the school system. It feels like the needs of neurodivergent kids were coming in last. The decision to begin reopening schools could make a crucial difference for enrollment numbers in Durham Public Schools, which lost 2,850 students at the beginning of the school year. More parents have told DPS officials they might find other options for their children, such as charter or private schools, unless instruction is restored. Megan Brown of Inverness Drive said in an email to DPS, virtual school is not working for our child and our family. We're being forced to change school districts unless Durham changes their mind. Not trying to pressure, it's just our reality. The DPS website has details of the plan to restore in-person instruction for families that want it. Students in kindergarten through fifth grade will attend in-person class every weekday, except for Wellness Wednesday, which will be remote. Students in grades 6 through 12 will be divided into three rotating groups, so each group has in-person instruction for 2 days a week and virtual school for 3 days. All students with IEPs have the option for in-person instruction up to 4 days per week. The reopening plan includes provision for personal protective equipment, social distancing, and other measures to reduce the risk of coronavirus transmission. Bettina Umstead, DPS board chair, said in a press release that students who opt to continue learning from home will help increase the safety for teachers returning to the classroom. She said, if you can, and if you are able, it's important you keep your students at home so that we can have proper social distancing and support our staff in this plan. I want everyone to know we care deeply, each and every one of us, about every single one of our educators, every single one of our students, and this is not a decision that we make lightly. And over to Chapel Hill for Sarah Picanio's article, How a Familiar Structure and New Parking Deck Aim to Usher in a New Era for Chapel Hill. Anyone who has ever lived in Chapel Hill has their own version of Franklin Street. It's the college town the rough air they played in. Bars they frequented, shops they bought University of North Carolina gear from, burger joints, record stores, seamstresses, head shops, and other small businesses they once loved. It's Sutton's and the Varsity, and He's Not Here, and memories folded into the cracked sidewalk and aging brick. The Franklin Street of today, of course, is a bit different. The storefronts are the same, but new businesses serve new residents. Some are shells of Franklin Street's past, with four lease signs in their windows and rings of dirt where neon lettering used to be. Some of these storefronts have been vacated due to COVID-19, but others have been empty for longer. The current version of Franklin Street needs a resurrection. Enter Rosemary Street. The East Rosemary Street Redevelopment Project, a partnership between the town's planning department and the Charlotte-based Grubb Properties, could change downtown Chapel Hill drastically in the coming years. It could also be the catalyst that launches the town into the 21st century, evolving it into an innovation hub on par with Raleigh and Durham. The three-phase project has already started. In February, the town blocked off the lower half of the Rosemary Columbia parking lot to begin work on the CVS Plaza building, or the Nation's Bank building, depending on your personal Franklin Street. The renovations began months ago, but the final steps will include giving the property new windows, a new HVAC system, and a new electrical system for continued use as office space. The second and third phases are when the tangible changes really kick in. Chapel Hill's Economic Development Officer, Dwight Bassett, says the construction of a 1,100-space, seven-story parking deck will begin in May or June and is expected to be completed in 2022. As the deck is built, Grubb Properties will try to get the final piece of that project puzzle approved, a 200,000-square-foot office buildings with two floors of lab space that could create 800 new jobs and generate almost $1.3 million in tax revenue for Chapel Hill. The project could also mean that the college town will finally find a way to keep its college graduates around. That's the hope, at least. Mayor Pam Hemminger says, "We have a lot of college kids and a lot of seniors. Then we get families because they come here for the good K-12 school system. But we're missing the young people who graduate from school. We're missing the people who don't want to pay those kinds of taxes, who don't have kids." Raleigh and Durham are regarded as two of the best cities for young professionals in the country. Chapel Hill is not. Hemminger says that while some companies may have opened up shop there because they were already considered business cities, previous town governments told commercial developers to stay out. It made a lasting impression on developers. Hemminger said, "We actually said we weren't interested in businesses before. Then we said, we have a long process and it doesn't actually yield a better outcome, and if you're not willing to go through our process, then you're not really committed." These platitudes are tied to downtown as much as the pizza places and fan stores are. In 2010, the Indy chronicled the town's plan to revitalize Franklin, Rosemary, and their side streets after they were decimated by the recessions. This plan looked similar to the proposals in a plan from 2001. Go back another decade, and a 1991 study of the area seems to mark the moment when downtown Chapel Hill became frozen in time. The town's objective back then was to minimize commercial zonings in favor of residential and office space that would preserve Chapel Hill's village concept. This led to today's Rosemary Street, which is awash with small parking lots and student apartments instead of an auxiliary business district. This planning concept also meant that recent college graduates as well as working-class residents would be largely unable to live in town. The town was suburbanized. Its property taxes increased. Heminger says that now Chapel Hill is more than 80% residential. Despite a long, strained relationship between students and town folks, Chapel Hill's large student population, most of them dependents with little or no income of their own, may be why the federal government decided to declare the 100 block of East Rosemary Street an Opportunity Zone in 2018. Opportunity zones mean investors get tax breaks for building in low-income areas with room for potential economic growth. The Opportunity Zone in Chapel Hill runs as far north as Estes Drive and includes parts of East Franklin Street and Martin Luther King Boulevard. Only 252 Opportunity Zones have been designated in North Carolina, and this is the only one in Orange County. While the county has one of the highest median household incomes in the state, Heminger suspects that the college student income may have given them a chance in the selection process. For Grubb Properties, this was the only way to make a profit on the CVS building, which he had bought in 2019. John Dye, executive vice president of Grubb, told the Indy, "We looked at the CVS building, Rosemary building, before it was for sale. It was very expensive and requires a lot of capital for investment." The real estate group already had a footing in the town. The founder, Bob Grubb, bought Glen Lennox, a mixed-use community just east of UNC campus in the 1980s. Since then, the owners have held onto the property and are currently renovating and rebuilding in the neighborhood. Heminger says of Clay Grubb, the CEO of Grubb Properties, and Bob's son, he loves Chapel Hill. He wanted to do something interesting here, and because there's an opportunity zone, it allows him to do it. Aside from the eventual office spaces and tax revenue, Chapel Hill also gets the opportunity to tackle another famed quirk, its parking problem. The East Rosemary Street parking deck that connects to CVS building is poorly lit and underutilized. Dye says there wasn't much Grubb could do except tear it down and rebuild. The parking deck will likely be completed in 2022, but the town's skyline won't change much. And I must stop there. John Feddersen, accompanied today by Noti McNoteface, who has been reading from the March 3rd issue of Indie Week. We'll return with the next issue soon. Our website, ncreadingservice.org. And the North Carolina Reading Service says thanks for listening and catch us next week.